Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Gaitis, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Please be seated. And welcome to this January 10, 2023 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on our oral calendar for this morning is Dynamic Energy Solutions versus FK Construction. Counsel, each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal time if you'd like. Please be mindful of those timing restrictions. They're indicated in the podium. And just for your consideration, you'll notice there are three microphones, and that's just for your convenience, whichever, and your preference. So if you're okay using the center podium, you certainly may. It elevates and lowers to your height. There's a button in front. If for health reasons you'd rather use the microphone or the podium closest to you, you certainly may do that as well. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. We do keep an audio recording of the proceedings, and that way we can distinguish, listeners can distinguish who's making which argument. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Craig from the firm of Eklund and Blando. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, FK Construction Funding, LLC. We're here at a very early dismissal from a motion to dismiss on a record, of course, just the pleadings. But there is some background, I think, that's important to understand. That this arose out of a commercial practice that is both very old and very common, that this presents an issue of nationwide impact. There are all kinds of businesses who are not going to qualify for bank financing, and they're going to be successful in the sense that they're going to make sales, but their customers are not going to pay them quickly, and they are going to need cash capital. And in those types of businesses, they typically turn to a factor who purchases accounts receivable at a discount. Now, for the very same reason that these businesses can't get bank financing, it's generally because they don't have much in the way of assets, so there's risk. And at issue in this case is a common practice in the factoring industry designed to mitigate that risk. And of course, by mitigating that risk, they're also lowering the price, essentially. Because they're lowering the risk, they're able to essentially offer a better discount on the sale of the accounts receivable. And so the practice that we're here today to talk about is the practice of going directly to what's in the language of the UCC Article 9, the account debtor. In the factoring transaction, the customer is the account debtor. The factoring client, the one who sells the accounts receivable, is the debtor. And then the factor is the assignee of the accounts receivable assignment. So in order to mitigate that risk, often the factor will approach the account debtor directly, much as it did in this case, and say, we are about to purchase this trade debt. Could you please verify that the amounts are actually due and owing, that you agree to pay them, and that you won't assert any defenses in the way of recoupment set off or otherwise. In this case, the project at issue went wrong. The debtor, Catalyst, it's alleged, failed to perform, and indeed there was a large default judgment entered against Catalyst. And our claim here is against the general contractor for the solar voltaic project that both Catalyst and Dynamic were working on. My client is a Florida business that isn't on the ground seeing what happens. They're in finance. They deal with the numbers, they deal with the money, and so they're purchasing this without knowing what's going on the ground, and they approach the account debtor, as we allege, to get that same verification. We have this pay application. At this point, my client, under its factoring agreement, is under no obligation whatsoever to purchase this account. Catalyst cannot force FK to purchase that account under the existing agreement. It is purely under Section 2.1.2 of the factoring agreement at FK's discretion. And so, as a result of the pay application and the what we're calling the estoppel agreements, which are in our addendum at page 57 and 58, FK approaches essentially to confirm that the pay application invoice amount is correct and will be paid to us in full within 90 days without recoupment, set off, defense, or counterclaim beyond 20% of said approved invoice, which is to say that the account debtor is essentially getting a 20% discount if things go wrong. And as a further inducement to us, you will not challenge to seek or set aside any mechanics liens filing made or on behalf of Catalyst. And I think the language of inducement is important here. The writing that was agreed to recognized that it was Dynamic that was inducing FK to purchase this accounts receivable that it wasn't otherwise required to do.
Can I jump in with a question? You mentioned the long-standing nature of these factoring agreements. What case, either in Minnesota or nationally, do you believe is the strongest case specifying that consideration exists under circumstances like this?
So I think there's probably three cases that we've cited here that are important. Hunts Point out of the Third Circuit, which is cited in our brief, and it's the 421 Federal Appendix 153. This is a case that is up on all fours that recognizes that there is a that the factor is coming in and giving a benefit to the account debtor, to the promisor, by ensuring that the subcontractor, the factor's client, is able to perform. Another case is LSQ Funding, which we cite, which also recognizes that the promisor, in getting consideration, that one aspect of consideration is that the promisor can also have the promisee confer a benefit on a third party, in this case being the factor's client. I would also direct the court to CGM Financial, cited in our brief, and Brookridge Funding Corp. These are all federal cases that are really recognizing this exact scenario.
I'm just curious. Well, I was looking for something stronger in precedent that were in a published federal case. I mean, the district court cases are interesting in the Third Circuit case. But were you able to find either state or federal any more binding precedent? It seems like this issue should have come up, given your position that these are longstanding, recurrent contracts, that the issue should have come up and been resolved in binding precedent that would be at least more persuasive than the cases you've relied on.
Well, Your Honor, I suppose the best I can do is the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, and under other federal decisions. I mean, I will say, while this is a common practice, it doesn't always lead to a lot of litigation, and there are a lot of other issues that often come up.
Sure.
Well, is that maybe because the agreements don't typically look like the ones in this case? In other words, the contracts in this case, or what you're alleging to be contracts, are pretty informal. In factoring situations, is that typical?
Well, the factoring contract is a very formal security agreement. What we're talking about here is the what would be called an estoppel certificate or an estoppel agreement, and this is actually a lot more in-depth than they usually are. It's usually an email from the factor to accounts payable with some very simple, you know, can you confirm that these are in line for payment and you agree to to pay them, and an email reply saying yes. That's typically when we talk about the estoppel certificate or estoppel agreements, all that we're talking about. Yes, there's a very formal factoring agreement that complies with Article 9, and that's kind of the formal document. Yes, there would be an underlying contract that's being factored. But the estoppel certificate or estoppel certificate is often just signed off on by an accounts payable clerk. It's not a 25-page terms and condition document.
So my concern about the consideration, which I think Judge Gilligan expressed concern about as well in his order, is, and I know your position is that the consideration is the detrimental reliance of FK on a Dynamics promise. But wasn't that detrimental reliance really only to the extent that Catalyst actually completed the work? In other words, didn't it solely relate to the underlying subcontract between Catalyst and Dynamic?
No, Your Honor, the detriment is advancing the funds that it wasn't obligated to advance. It's the roughly, you know, $140,000 that it wasn't obligated to pay to anyone, and it only paid after Dynamic promised that it would be repaid in the normal course of business. That's the detriment that it incurred. And we're dealing here, I suppose, just turning back to, I briefly addressed the notion of benefit conferred, and I think under the federal cases we've cited, and this general principle that the general contractor is benefited by its subcontractor having the resources to perform in a timely and efficient manner, that's a benefit. But again, strictly turning to the detriment, FK's legal status at the time of this presentation of the estoppel agreement, it is under no obligation to advance money to anyone. It is Dynamic that has a definitive promise to pay to FK within 90 days up to 80% of this amount. FK then chooses to purchase the accounts receivable from Catalyst because of this agreement. That's an indisputable legal detriment. I know appellant tries to make this about past consideration, and we recognize that issue, but we're not trying to enforce a contract that Catalyst is a party to, or a contract that is between Dynamic and Catalyst. Between an existing parties to an existing contract, we can talk about past consideration being insufficient.
Isn't Dynamic in these agreements essentially, though, agreeing to pay FK in its capacity as an assignee and not as a separate, contracting body?
Well, it's certainly not stated in the agreement. I mean, what it says is that it agrees to be 80% of the invoice amount directly to FK. And it would have the language itself here is that it's trying to induce FK to proceed with the purchase of the accounts receivable. That's consideration. I think the issues are relatively straightforward. This is an absolute mine run example of first principles of consideration that could be based on 200-year-old case law, not just the more recent persuasive decisions that we've presented. FK had no obligation to purchase those accounts. It got a promise from the general contractor that if it did purchase those accounts, they would be paid within 90 days, at least up to 80%. That's a contract. That's consideration. I suppose turning to the remaining issue is if the court were to affirm that there is no consideration, we do have to address the issue of promissory estoppel. And the issue here is the estoppel agreement within the same subject matter as Catalyst subcontract. Now, I would submit that within the context of promissory estoppel and same subject matter, it's never been applied to contracts with different parties. Certainly, there's no case law that I've found to that effect. And so we have that. Beyond that, the subject matter of the subcontract was to participate in the construction of a solar voltaic project. The estoppel agreements are about a financial transaction between a Florida finance firm and the factoring business and the general contractor of a project. That is not the same subject matter. They're unrelated in time because the subcontract would have been formed months ago. They're not the same parties. They're not the same scope of work. They're not even the same promises. The subcontract would have had Catalyst be paid for 100% of its work. This estoppel agreement is only for 80%. So how can there be no promissory estoppel claim based on the same subject matter when we're dealing here with different promises, different parties, a different type of transaction, and therefore, to the extent the court holds that there was no consideration for the estoppel agreements, we still have a definite and firm promise of a substantial character to pay these amounts in the pay application up to 80% to the factor. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd reserve my time for rebuttal.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal either way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Kyle Ubel from Frederickson and Byron on behalf of Dynamic Energy this morning. There are two issues on this appeal. First, whether the district court properly dismissed FK's breach of contract claim against Dynamic Energy because there was no contract between the two parties due to lack of legally sufficient consideration. And second, whether the district court properly dismissed FK's promissory estoppel claim against Dynamic Energy because there is an express contract covering the same subject matter, that is the subcontract between Dynamic Energy and Catalyst. The answer to both of these questions is yes. The district court properly dismissed these claims, and the judgment of the district court therefore should be affirmed. I'm going to take just a minute to recap the parties by way of background. So we represent Dynamic Energy, the prime contractor on a solar project. Catalyst was a subcontractor on that project. They're not a party to this appeal, but they were a party to the case, and there's a default judgment against them in this case in favor of Dynamic Energy. And then, of course, Mr. Craig represents FK Funding. To be clear, there is no allegation of a negotiated written agreement between FK and Dynamic Energy. Rather, there was a subcontract between Dynamic Energy and Catalyst, Catalyst serving as the subcontractor. And later there was a construction financing agreement that is called a factoring agreement between FK and Catalyst. But Dynamic Energy was not a party to the factoring agreement. Under the factoring agreement, Catalyst agreed that FK would now stand in its shoes with respect to receiving payments from Dynamic Energy under the subcontract. However, FK has not sued Dynamic Energy pursuant to the subcontract. And this is because, presumably, Catalyst defaulted on its obligations and failed to perform under the subcontract. Indeed, Dynamic Energy sued Catalyst for more than $2 million in this case and obtained a default judgment in that amount. And FK presumably understands that any claim it brings under the subcontract for approximately $150,000 would be barred by offset. And so, therefore, FK has attempted to invent a new theory of liability using these emails that FK sent to Dynamic Energy. And it's a Rule 12 motion. We understand their allegations and we don't obviously dispute them. FK alleges that it sent certain emails containing questions and requests for confirmation about the facts on the ground with respect to the subcontract. And FK alleges that Dynamic Energy responded, agreed to these emails. Under the Rule 12 standard, again, I reiterate, these facts are assumed to be true on this appeal and they were assumed to be true in the district court. However, the law understands that we say things to one another all the time and we may respond agreed, but this formulaic exchange of words is not enough to have a binding and enforceable agreement. Contracts 101 tells us you have to also have legally sufficient consideration. On appeal, Catalyst now insists, as it did in the district court, that its alleged consideration is legally sufficient. This is at paragraph 30 of the counterclaim. FK alleges as purported consideration that, quote, Dynamic Energy induced FK to fund Catalyst to ensure that the Catalyst subcontract could be performed, and FK did indeed fund in reliance on Dynamic Energy's promise. Again, that's
if I could just interrupt, it seems like FK's big argument regarding consideration, probably the stronger argument is that it detrimentally relied on Dynamic's promise in those emails to pay before it, you know, funded Catalyst to complete the work. And I'm just wondering, Minnesota law does recognize that detrimental reliance can be a form of consideration. What is your response to that argument? What's your best response?
I think the response is, even with respect to detrimental reliance, there has to be a connection. So if we look at what the district court said, if we look at what Judge Gilligan said, this is at page 8 of our brief, Catalyst already had an obligation to perform, I'm quoting his order, Catalyst already had an obligation to perform under the subcontracts and to complete the projects. The fact that FK would not have extended funding to Catalyst would not have relieved Catalyst of its obligations under the subcontract. So there still has to be a connection. If I could have your honor's patience, I would like to address the two forms of consideration in turn. And because of your question, I'll talk about detrimental reliance first. So FK asserts this theory of detrimental consideration. That is, FK asserts that it incurred a detriment by advancing the funding to FK. However, this argument fails for the same reason as the beneficial consideration argument. As the district court observed, the language I just read, there must still be a connection between the detriment and the person against whom you're asserting a contract. Here, the funding was advanced to Catalyst, not to Dynamic Energy, and Dynamic Energy received no benefit as a result of the funding. So Dynamic Energy was already entitled to receive the benefit of Catalyst's performance, whether or not FK incurred that detriment. And then I think it's also worth noting, as reflected by the judgment of the district court, Catalyst actually failed to perform despite FK's funding. And these conclusions of the district court are correct under well-established Minnesota law. In two published cases of this court, the Gilley case and the Soft Choice case cited on page 9 of our brief, this court has held that new consideration, and we read those cases to apply to beneficial consideration or detrimental reliance, must be present to support a new contract. Similarly, the Abbott case cited at page 13 of our brief from the Minnesota Supreme Court holds that a new and independent contract requires new and independent consideration. And relying on these well-established legal principles, the district court properly determined that the consideration alleged by FK could not support a new contract because it is not new consideration. This result also has been reached in two other cases that are directly on point factually. In the Factor King case, the Ramsey County District Court previously reached the same result in a case that was nearly identical to this case. And that judgment, that defense judgment, was not appealed by a plaintiff having the same individual principal.
Just to back you up, do the cases that you cited, other than the other case that Judge Gilligan wrote, do the cases that you cited address detrimental reliance as a form of consideration or some benefit as a form of consideration?
We think they, sorry to interrupt.
That's all right.
We think they do. In particular, the Dooley Mac case from the Federal District of South Carolina, and I understand that Mr. Craig says that he doesn't think that decision addresses the consideration arguments you just suggested. I think that we did, and we would invite the court to dig a little deeper on that. If you actually look at the complaint that was filed in that case, you'll see that they actually alleged both kinds of consideration, and the court said that the allegations were insufficient. So even though the analysis of the court and the opinion is short shrift, if you actually go look at the complaint that the court was looking at, the complaint did allege both kinds of consideration. So we think the Dooley Mac case, when you go and dig into the pleadings and look at what was alleged there, we think that case is still on all fours.
Is your only argument against Brookridge Funding and Hunt's Point that these are unreported federal cases not binding in Minnesota? I notice your brief doesn't get into the merits and reasoning of those.
I'm only smiling because it was the next thing I was going to talk about. We're not going to be disingenuous. We're not going to come in here and try to split hairs. Those cases say what they say, and there is a split of authority. I think Your Honor is right. Those are persuasive to some degree, but they're unpublished. They're not from this jurisdiction. But we don't dispute that those cases go the other way. We do note that the Platinum Funding case relied on by FK does not address the legal arguments about consideration that we've raised, and so we don't think that case does apply in any way.
Were you able to find any federal appellate decisions, published or not, that support your position regarding consideration?
The answer is no. So they've cited the cases, the handful of cases they've found. We believe that this court's decisions in Soft Choice and Gilley, although factually distinct, announce clear black-letter law on contract that apply cleanly here, as well as the Minnesota Supreme Court's Abbott case. And then, of course, we have Judge Gilligan's prior order from Ramsey County that was not appealed by a party having the same principle as FK in this case.
Well, that
and
would
we've
be no,
got the...
That would be no more binding on this court than the opinion, than the order that we're reviewing now.
Agreed. I don't mean to suggest that it's binding in any way, but I do think that a jurist's reasoning can be persuasive. But
the reasoning's the same in that case and this case. I mean, there's no...
Agreed.
Judge Gilligan applied the same rationale.
I agree. And then we've, of course, got the duly met case from South Carolina. As the court considers this case and the competing authorities, we finally note as an equitable matter what I think Your Honor was getting at. It makes little sense for FK to prevail on the equities. It is undisputed that Catalyst did not perform here and that a default judgment has been entered in Dynamics' favor against Catalyst in the amount of more than $2 million. And FK now suggests that Dynamic Energy should pay it an additional $150,000. And that just doesn't make any sense in terms of basic fairness and the equities. And so for these reasons, we think the district court's dismissal of the breach of contract claim should be affirmed. I'll use my remaining 4 minutes here to talk about the promissory estoppel claim. The district court also properly dismissed FK's promissory estoppel claim. It is black-letter law in Minnesota that promissory estoppel applies only where there are no contractual rights, and therefore an express contract covering the same subject matter bars a promissory estoppel claim. That rule of law is established in this court's published grueling decision cited at page 15 of our brief. And we understand from the briefing that FK concedes that this is the standard, and I think that's clear from Mr. Craig's comments this morning. That is, whether there is an express contract covering the same subject matter. FK argues that the factoring agreement is a different subject matter than the alleged promise in these emails. However, that was not our argument to the district court, and that's not the district court's analysis. Rather, as the district court correctly observed, the alleged promises in the emails are the same subject matter as the subcontract, and FK now stands in Catalyst's shoes with respect to the subcontract. Indeed, FK's entire position starts from the proposition that it now stands in FK's shoes, in Catalyst's shoes with respect to the subcontract. As the district court correctly held, the emails that form the basis of the promissory estoppel claim simply repeated amounts or terms or questions about the subcontract, thus confirming that there's, you draw the Venn diagram here, there's overlap, there's subject matter similarity. Mr. Craig mentioned this morning that there's contracts between different parties. Again, we need to remember FK is the assignee here, right? So FK is no longer a stranger to the subcontract. So this is not a situation where FK has no contract that it's part of if the court affirms a dismissal of a promissory estoppel claim. It's not some catch-22, heads I win, tails I win. It does have a contract. It has the subcontract. It just simply knows that if it's sued on the subcontract, it won't have a claim because we've got a $2 million hole over here that would offset the $150,000 liability they're asserting. For these reasons, we believe the district court's dismissal of the promissory estoppel claim was correct, and the judgment of the district court should be affirmed. If the court has no further questions, I'll yield my remaining time.
Doesn't appear as if the panel members have any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for Appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you again, Your Honor. Daniel Craig for the appellant. I'd first like to return to two questions that the court asked about. Where are the cases and are these agreements really this informal? And I think the answer that I should have given that actually kind of brings these together is these cases generally exist where the account debtor is saying the accounts payable clerk had no authority to enter into these agreements. There is a lot of case law, and that's usually where these estoppel certificate agreement cases go, is on the issue of authority, which dovetails into something that Mr. Ubel said about how there's no pleaded negotiations regarding these agreements. And I suppose, the reason is this is still a notice pleading state. We pled essentially the agreements and the basis for consideration. When we look at the pleading standard of, that the plaintiff can show no set of facts that would entitle them to relief and what we would see in discovery come out, these agreements were negotiated by Dynamics General Counsel. Because there is essentially no lack of authority argument in this case, that's why we're heading down the path of consideration, which with respect, I think ultimately is a dry well for the respondent because the consideration law really should be so clear here that there is consideration. So turning to a couple of the cases that counsel cited, the Soft Choice and Gilley, these are classic past consideration cases and they involve the same parties. We're here, of course, talking about FK, which was not a party to the subcontract. Having an assignment of accounts receivable under UCC Article 9 does not make FK a party to the subcontract. It simply means it has been assigned a right to payment. That is all. And really, what essentially Article 9 does with would be Minnesota Statutes Chapter 336-9-404 simply provides that that right to payment can't be discharged by the account debtor after it's received notice of the assignment. It's essentially the assignment and the UCC provision is really just meant to facilitate the financing. FK doesn't become obligated in any way, shape, or form on the subcontract. It is not a party to the subcontract. Therefore, we're again dealing here with different parties when we look at the same subject matter analysis for promissory estoppel. Lastly, the Dooley Mac case. This is a federal case on a federal 12B6 motion. As the court is not aware, the federal courts have a much more difficult standard, the Iqbal Twombly standard, for analyzing a motion to dismiss under the federal rules. There, the court really is looking for a lot of detailed facts to show plausibility. Here in Minnesota, we still follow the no set of facts standard. We alleged very clearly that we were induced to enter into this transaction without any obligation, and we both conferred a benefit on Dynamic, also the third party catalyst to receive the funding, and incurred a legal detriment by advancing funds. We had no other legal obligation to do so. For that reason, there is consideration. And I'd also note the Dooley Mac court said that it was dismissing without prejudice to allow an amendment to cure the defect. So clearly, the Dooley Mac court thought that even under the federal standard, it could be repled to meet that, and there wasn't some insuperable legal rule barring the case in that matter. With that, Your Honor, if the court has any more questions.
It appears no further questions from the panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, the matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. I will say that occasionally we get really good briefing in this court and outstanding oral advocacy, and we certainly did today, and we appreciate the counsel's effort, and both your clients should be very happy with the representation. Very nice job. Of course, only one of you is going to win, so that's the way it goes. Thank you. Matter submitted, and we'll turn to our next matter on our oral calendar.